Mr. Chadwick, Reel 15. The next thing really is how you, while you were in Malaysia on detached duty at the plantations, is how you actually organised your flying patrols. How did that work?
Well, first of all, is when you, once you've got to know your platoon, is to pick your men. You can't always pick everybody you want, but to pick, in other words, put square pegs and square holes, the men who are more suited to it. Again, becoming, some lads were frightened of going out armed in the dark. So use them majority for the daytime routine things, leave them on duties around the plantation, and pick a select squad. Although you didn't let them know it was the select squad, they were the men you could feel most comfortable with. That's the way I picked them, and it could work. And then as far as the flying patrol, all that we needed was a word and a location. The vehicles always stood by, tanked up with petrol, the drivers always stood by, the lads were always stood by. And we were away like a fire engine within minutes.
What vehicle would you use?
Bedford's. I always remember that.
Just a truck?
Just a truck, yeah. But they were all soft-skin vehicles. But at a later date, we had to have protection from grenades. But that came later in the...
And what weapons would you take? What weapons were you using at the time?
Mostly small arms. Small arms. Some, two or three would have rifles, but majority was Sten, which was the most adequate weapon for close range.
So you'd go to where you'd been called to, like, for instance, at the quarry?
Well, that's true. But you'd be very cautious, because approaching the quarry, you don't just drive up to the house and say, I've arrived. You have to get out. We say, oh, we know that place. We saw it 3 days ago. So we'll debus at that little track leading up to it and then move in, because we don't know whether we're going to find these, what should we call them? They were bandits, they were insurgents, they were CTs. They changed the names. At the time we were there, mostly it was insurgents. They might be lurking, waiting for us to give us a clue. So this is where you have to be extra careful on your approaches. Once you got near, the local people who were still left would come out screaming. Then you knew you were clear. Then what I used to do was throw three or four men as a security cordon, while we, for want of another word, negotiated, asked them what had gone on, how many there were, had they fled, which direction, any information relevant until the arrival of the police. Then they would take over. The OCPD of that district, Pat Grosvenor, was a great man.
OCPD would be?
Officer Commanding Police District.
And what... You were talking, what sort of relationship did you have with Gibson, was it?
Goldsboro, sorry.
Matt
Goldsboro and I, outstanding relationship. I've got letters from him upstairs when I left. He was a great man. Sense of humour. Back to that commodity, you don't get a lot of common sense. Really sensible man. And we discussed a lot of ideas and tactics, which were put into practice of late days. As I said, Peter, the start of any campaign is the hardest, because everybody learns from you. The mistakes you made and the things you learned is all passed on to the people who's come up later.
So, did you know who your enemy was? I mean, did you understand who these people were?
We weren't interested. I made a point of finding out what it was all about. And the little lectures I used to give to explain to the troops, they were what we call the MPAGA originally, the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army, during the war. And when the war ended, they wanted a better deal. Now, that's a political scenario which goes on. They proved, their argument was, they proved that when all the planters were taken prisoner by the Japanese, they ran the plantations, the Sounds. So they wanted a little bit of embarrassment for it when they came back, which apparently wasn't forthcoming. All part of a big plot. And at the time in the Far East, there had been a rising in Burma, there was risings in India, and it was all communistic elements. So it was a bigger picture, but all that we were interested in was Malaya. That was the thing.
And you were in northern region, northern sub-district, and you, I mean, you were with 2nd Battalion Gurkha Rifles, 2nd Battalion 2nd Gurkha Rifles, 1st Battalion 6th Gurkha Rifles, 1st and 2nd Battalions Malay Regiment. How did you liaise with those, the Gurkhas and them?
Very little, unless you were doing a very big exercise, which I never did, thank God. So very little of them. Very little.
Would they also be dispersed?
They were doing the same job. Somewhere else in the state of Kedah.
So, how did the situation develop then? At first, they didn't attack if you were there, basically. Did they not ever shoot at you?
Oh, yes.
During this early stage, I mean. I know they did later.
The only time they'd engage you, if they had to. If they could get away, they would. But if you were closing in on a conks, is the word, on a conks that they were in, this is one of these old street top or ceiling down on that, they would fire and fling. Let fly as fast as they could and disappear into the la line. Or the jungle, especially in the Gunung Bongsu, which was absolutely the roughest jungle in the whole of Malaya, bar none. And it was, you must never say it was non-operational, but it was as near non-operational as you could get. Once you got in there, you were doing a mile and a half a day, hacking your way, and trying to map read, and trying to get your bearings was hence. When we started doing the 8 and 9 and 10 day patrols, you'd go and live out there amongst them. Which didn't pay that many dividends, but at least it kept them on the toes. They knew we were out and about.
How soon was it before you started doing that?
Not long after what we were talking. Only weeks.
Anything else in the initial period before you started doing the long-range patrols?
Well, the murder of planters was becoming such common day that it was getting out of hand. You see, they were coming up dressed as tappers on the rubber trees when the planter came out to inspect. Most of them were Tamils that were doing the tapping. But of course, the breakdown of Malaya, I think, was about 40% straight Chinese, 20%, 25% Tamils, and 25% Malays, predominantly Chinese. So you didn't know who these staffers were, you'd be always on your mettle. But when these planters went out, this chap would pop from behind the tree, kill him, and disappear for good. You wouldn't see him again. He would go and join the band somewhere, which made it very, very hard for security to try and stop these killings, which wasn't easy by any standards.
Any other incidents in the early period you recall?
Yes. One particular incident, we moved to an area. And we went out one night, a place called Kuala Katel. as a familiarisation patrol. Go out in the dark and make your way out and back to base to give the two or three NCOs I had with me an insight to what it'd be like. As we came down this path, and I can tell you the time, ironically, 2:15 in the morning, never forget it, I had an eerie feeling myself something was wrong. And we were doing it properly, quietly, no talking, no smoking, doing it as if we were in real action. Turned round and I saw a forecrest across this globe. As we approached it, fortunately, I think there was four of us. I gave a signal to fan out. And then a hail of bullets, and I mean a hail of bullets, shot at us. We went to ground, returned the fire, and I and another person saw this man, soldier, whatever, and shot him. And he went down. Now there's another man there that I put a phone magazine into him. And I don't know what I thought at the moment, but he didn't fall. And then we heard screaming and shouting. Then we shouted British. And what had happened, there was a Malayan constable out there with about 10 of the local guards of this area, Chinese, Tamils, obviously he had under command, all armed, very badly trained. Now what they'd done, they'd fired at us, thinking we were Chinese, which transpired later. And luckily they didn't kill any of us. The policeman was dead, dead as a dodo. And what they'd been doing, they'd been firing like that.
Holding the guns up without looking.
They're frightened. Frightened to death. And the reason I emphasise that I put a magazine in this other soldier, when first light came next morning, that soldier was a figure target that they'd been using to practice. That's the reason he didn't fall. Well, there was an old back door in the vicinity. Two of the lads got at each end of the back door. We lifted the policeman, Osman, onto the back door, ran to the dressing station with him, but end of story. He was a goner. There was two or three of the others wounded, but not badly, flesh wounds, bullet wounds. And they admitted they thought we were a Chinese patrol coming to attack their plantation. So they let rip. As a result of that, I finished up in Al Star for the murder of Constable Osmond.
Al Star's
the capital of Kedah. And all a proper court, British justice, Gowden, Wigan, everything. The reason I mention it, Pat Goldsborough came up, the OCBD, and the Malayan women, the prams, you never touch them. If they're getting into a truck, you don't help them down or help them up. You don't touch Malayan women. At least that kind of thing. After the case, Mrs. Osman, I think, was awarded $750, Malayan bucks, which was $2.40 at the time. And she came running across to go up to Captain Goldsborough, threw her arms around him, and Pallada in Malaya, which he knew, he spoke the language well. And I said, what's she saying? I said, tell her I'm sorry for what happened. Of course he pretended. And he burst out laughing. He says, do you know what she's just saying? I said, no. She said she's got two other brothers. Any chance of me getting them in the police? She'd never have 700 bucks in her life. That's absolutely true. But not 2 years, and there was no getting bills. But that was sad, but there's nothing we could have done about it.
What was the prosecution case against you? Didn't sound like they could have had much of a case.
We had a solicitor from Australia came over. He wore an olive green with a crown on his. He had the honorary rank major, and he was our defence. And wasn't necessary, but I mean, it was necessary to save our lives, because how they missed us for that first day, they missed us because they were frightened. And they thought that by firing us, it would have run away. Maybe the Chinese would. But we'd know where to run. We didn't intend running. We just went to ground return. One of the lads, he was reported as wounded. But what happened? There was an old tree that fell across the path. And he took cover behind that. And these boys must have hit the tree, and all the bark shot off and peppered his face. When I turned around, he was a mask of blood. When I saw him alone, with nine in his head. But when he was cleaned up, there's a few stitches and that here and there. That was more love than management that we got away with that.
Was it quite common for plantations to organise their own defence force? Because that seems to have been, I mean, it could have happened a lot of times.
Ultimately, they did, but they got. You must bear in mind that gradually now, at this period, the Palestine police are starting to move in. A lot of them, when they were disbanding the Palestine police, came across and joined the Malayan police, and they were instructing them, giving them better instruction, teaching them how to do the job, and they became more efficient.
Did you not have to have some system of notifying plantations when you were going to do a familiarisation patrol through their area?
Well,
or wouldn't this happen more often?
Good question. We certainly have no liaison with them. If we were going on an operation, would constitute going through their territory, should we say, we would certainly inform them. But we thought we were just going for a little walk about that night, quietly, tactically, but not expecting to meet anyone. As a matter of fact, we'd only about 3 or 4 magazines each, just for chance anything did go wrong, which did.
Did you have any intelligence as to the movements of the Malaysian, the guerrillas, or whatever you call them?
We got that from the police. Built it to our battalion airport, company headquarters, and then, depending which area, filtered out to me or the other battalion.
And what would it say? What sort of information would you get?
Like all information, it's got to be really sussed out, because false information was being given. These people were frightened to death of the insurgents. And they used to come in at night, and we know they did, and you couldn't blame them. Get all the food at gunpoint, and if one of them had betrayed them, they'd have gone down and slaughtered half the village. It's blackmail. That's why when we were out, we would go into night patrols, little things, and walk around the villages, go into a council, and look along where they were all sleeping, the tappers. Now, all the men who were suntanned, that was all right. But if you saw a pale face among them, grab it. Because these jungle boys, they never saw the sky above living in the jungle. They were paying, one, they were undernourished, and they were run down. And they would lie up at them and be quite safe, because they knew nobody dare touch them. If they had, they'd be annihilated. And that was their protection. You know, they might just lie up the night. We caught quite a few.
Now, what was the terrain like on the rubber estates in Kedah? I mean, it's difficult for... I can't imagine at all. I mean...
On the terrain, on the estates and that, is fine. There is no problem. You're not even into the lalang yet, the elephant grass. That terrain was perfectly...
So what was it?
Grass. Normal terrain. And of course... The rubber trees were all laid in unison. There was no growth. You could walk through a pleasant walk, in actual fact. That terrain was perfect.
And what about when you went into the lalang, the elephant grass?
Now you started. You've got all the elements. Now, for a start off, we haven't gone on at this stage to the 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 day patrols. That's a different kettle of fish.
We'll come on to that later, yes.
The lalang and the elephant grass wasn't hard at all. We're talking grass 4 or 5 foot high. But you could scoop that away. You didn't need a machete. You could just wave it away. There was a lot of sugar cane, which was handy for the old cut a lump off and stuff, which we very sustaining, which played a part later on in the Russian business. Again, I would class that as routine, the elephant brass. Your arms were with necklaces.
Would you go into the lalang on sort of familiarisation patrols?
And at night, because it's a place where you could lie up and not be seen. So you could go and try and let them know you were here, there, and everywhere. And try and instill into them, wherever they went, we'd be there, sort of thing. These were the objects of the exercise.
Now, what about things like rations while you were based in the plantations? I mean, how would the company quartermaster get the food up to you?
Oh, no problem. He'd come from Kirkland out in the plantation. A lot of time we had his own rations. He didn't bring the food. Well, he didn't bring cook food. He sent rations out. We had his own cook.
What, each platoon?
Oh, yeah. On a South Plantain unit.
And what sort of food would you get?
At that stage.
Do you remember what it was?
Normal army grub, kippers, plenty of potatoes, plenty of chips, veg, and of course we have the tropical stuff, the melons and all this business. All we fed quite well. Porridge, tin milk, tin sausages, all the normal field food, as you might say.
So, this is the first phase. Now, anything else before you started doing longer patrols into the jungle itself?
Not really. Rather little leisure activities, other than reading, a bit of playing cricket if you had a makeshift bat, a bit of football, as lads always get. I always took a set of boxing gloves out, and the lads used to have a bit of a go at milling. At night time, in your off-duty period.
Would you have a mess at all, or would you just be on a platoon basis? Not.
Oh, on a platoon basis. I would dine with the corporals. Not to, for any snobbish reasons, just to keep that balance. Because familiarity can't bring content. So the corporals and myself, we'd have our little table, most likely in the same room, but we sit at that table, and the lads were, and it was great. There's not enough. But if you don't, I feel you lose your control.
Would there be much drinking during these?
We haven't had a chance to drink much because we had a little canteen, which was strict, rigid. Now, if Christmas time and that, certainly had the parties, but providing you weren't on call. If you were on call, it was better.
And what about, were you warned, or were the lads warned about contact with Malaysian women? VD and things like that?
Oh, well, that goes without saying. All soldiers are. It doesn't make a blanket.
Was there much trouble with VD in the battalion?
Not a lot. We have. The lads didn't get the chance. You see, it was only in Penang or Georgetown. Well, we were. We'd go three or four months and we might get sent back for a week. That's for showers, medicals. I'll come on to the diseases and that we all suffer. You get a break then we had the odd case, just because we've gone back to Penang. But out there, there's no chance of contact. I've no doubt some dodged in somewhere along the line, but that wasn't the problem.
Now, what about the longer patrols then? How were they organised?
Well, to start with, we realised how many lessons we had to learn. Now, I'd like to say at this stage, my first two or three patrols, I think there were 3 or 4 days. Out we went, and of course we'd stay 3 or 4 days rations. So we had bully beef, tin fish, tins of milk, tins. Once you got out there, as far as it, most of our patrolling was done in the Gunung Bongsu, which in anybody's language was tough. Now once you get into that jungle, you have a lot of fallen trees, rotten, and they're slippy. And I realised very, very quickly, the chap carrying the tins of bully beef, etc., would slip and crash on the tree. And he's got damaged ribs. So he's a liability for the next 3 days. So you have to think about this. You have to think about which was more sustaining. And I worked a system out where we had breakfast at morning, obviously, and then we only had one meal for the rest of that day, preferably at lager time at night, before we lager and set up camp. And what I decided on, which I noted up in all my patrol reports, thereafter every patrol, after the first one, our big pack was full of rice, because it's very sustaining food, and interspersed amongst it was tins of sardines. And that's what we practically did on. Because if you fell, he had the cushion of the rice, so I wasn't getting broke with damaged ribs and collarbones, jarred. And we found that the rice was really sustaining, more rice than anything. And we were sure how to cook it, to get the best of it, by the locals.
How was that?
Was boiled it in your nestings. Once you boil it, drain the water off, and everybody, they tell me, being in England, the essence of all these dishes is the dried rice, how it's cooked and dried, and put banana leaves on top for 10 to 15 minutes. It sucked all the dampness out of the rice, and it was nice on its own. and then sardines in tomato sauce, interspersed among them. They're a lovely meal.